Well, hello there, everyone. Welcome back to Radio Solar System for our third broadcast of the fall of 2021. And this now is part of Module 2 in the course. So you've had a bit of time now to look at the introduction and look at the orientation. You should have a pretty good idea of what you're getting into at this point. So in Module 2, we take a step aside from the main ideas of the course to do some review of science concepts and then earth science concepts that you'll need in order to go through this course. Now, this modification came about really from comments from last year's course when people said that it would be very useful to have more of a review, particularly of the earth science concepts, early in the course, just to make it easier when things come in later. So that's what we're going to do. In the first part of this module, we revisit some basic scientific concepts, some things that you probably learned about in the past but have likely forgotten about or not had much interest in, but which you will now need in this course. And in the second part, we move along to some specific things that relate to earth sciences and geology, things that will be necessary again, in particular for understanding sections that we have on terrestrial planets. So as always, the transition from one slide to another is indicated by a very distinctive sound. And we're now going to move along to the next slide, which gives a review of what we're going to cover. As I said before, it's an earth science course, but we don't really have prerequisites, so we need to fill in some of these blanks. We've got to figure out how to deal with enormous ranges of numbers. That's one of the first problems we have. And we also have to figure out how to deal with very long periods of time, and sometimes very short periods of time, too. We're going to need to talk a little bit about the structure of matter, things like particles, atoms, elements, and isotopes, particularly. Isotopes are very important in earth science and planetary science. And then we're going to need to, in the second part, talk about some things about minerals, rocks, and key aspects of earth sciences, things like tectonics and various other concepts that are important to understand, and some other things that relate to energy and particularly to electromagnetic radiation, which is very important. So we have a wide range of things to deal with. And in the first part, we're going to stick to some basic science stuff that most of you should have done as high school students, and hopefully you'll remember most of this stuff. So let's move along now. So back to our next slide again, which is our picture of the Andromeda Galaxy. And we're pretending that we're actually in that galaxy. We're in the Milky Way galaxy, which would look very much like this if we were to look at it from a long distance. As you know, we're just one planet and one solar system within a galaxy that's absolutely enormous. And that's nothing compared to the scale of the universe. Okay? Solar system itself is about 4.6 billion years old. And there's probably about 300 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And we don't really know the number of galaxies in the universe with certainty. And the universe is at least 93 billion light years across. So clearly, right away, we've got some enormous numbers to deal with here. And this can be an issue for many people, trying to visualize these numbers. Even though we think we can do it, we're not always that good at it. So now to our next slide, which is number 4. We need to think about how we're going to deal with these big numbers. If we take Andromeda, for example, which we were just talking about, that's the closest galaxy to the Milky Way. But that's a bit of a relative term, because that's 2.5 million light years away from us. But what's a light year? What does it really mean? And the universe is over 13 billion years old, but what does that really mean in terms of the life of the universe and the events within it? So the problem is that large numbers can become incomprehensible very quickly. And we need a method of dealing with these. And most of you probably know that we deal with these by using what's called exponential notation. But let's just briefly look at this, just to make sure that you understand these principles. To the next slide now. So we're going to be talking about things that are incredibly small, like atoms and particles. And we're going to talk about planets, stars, which are large, galaxies, which are enormous. We've got distances that are very long, like the distances between planets or stars, or the wavelength of an X-ray, which is an extremely short distance. So the things we use normally to visualize things become cumbersome because of these ranges. I mean, if we were to write the mass of a hydrogen atom in kilograms, it's a meaningless number. And similarly, if we were to write the mass of the sun in kilograms, it would also be a meaningless number. And we get around this by using exponential notation. That's really what we do. There are a number of other things that have been tried, but they have their problems as well. So let's just look at some of these other methods we might use quickly in the next slide. So you could stick in some commas. that makes things a little bit easier to read. It means it's a bit easier to count the zeros because they come in groups of threes, but it really doesn't get you around the problem. These numbers are basically incomprehensible when you do it this way. Another way we can do it is by introducing prefixes that indicate the sizes of units as well. And we're all familiar with this. Let's just quickly look at that method. Well, let's say you use a kilo for 1,000, so a kilometre is 1,000 metre. We could use mega for 1,000,000. We could use giga for 1,000,000,000. That's the same thing as 1,000,000,000. Think about gigabytes of storage on your computer. You might have terabytes of storage on your computer, which is the same thing as 1,000,000,000,000 or 1,000,000,000,000, which is the same thing as 1,000,000,000,000. Okay? 10,000,000,000, actually. And we can do the same thing for weights, too. If we did it this way, we could write the mass of the sun in billions of tons, but it would still be a meaningless number, basically. It really doesn't help us very much. So we really need to find a better way around this. So let's have a look at the next slide now. So, essentially, most of these methods of handling numbers do not help us. They might be useful in a particular context or if we're comparing two things in a certain size range, but for the most part, they're just a source of confusion. And the route to reducing this confusion is using exponential notation, which is standard in science for dealing with numerical quantities. So let's just have a look at how this works. So we're now on slide 9. Basically, we just count the zeros and we express it as an exponent. So in other words, 1,000 becomes 1 times 10 to the power of 3. 1,000,000 is 1 times 10 to the power of 6. That very long number you see there is 1 times 10 to the power of 30. Okay? The mass of the sun, when we do it this way, becomes essentially 2 times 10 to the 30 kilograms. Now that's a better way of expressing things. It takes up less space, and we can see right away when things are bigger and smaller, or smaller than one another, by the changes in the exponents. What the exponent means, really, is that we just move the decimal place 30 places to the right in order to get to that number. So this is a standard method in science. It's something you should have dealt with in math before, but you will encounter it quite a bit in this course simply because of the size and the large ranges of numbers that we have to deal with. So let's take another look at the next slide. Here's another example, or some examples. The distance between the Earth and the Sun is about 149 million kilometers. Okay? So that's why it's confusing. Okay? So much better off to write that. You can write that in meters as 1.5496 times 10 to the 11 meters. And you can check that by working it through. We can approximate it too. We can say that it's about 1.5 times 10 to the 11 meters or about 1.5 times 10 to the 8 kilometers because there's 1,000 meters in a kilometer. And the distance between the Earth and the Moon is quite a lot less than that. It's 384,400 kilometers. So what would that be in exponential form? Well, you could write that as 3.84 times 10 to the 5 kilometers. But for the sake of convenience, we're going to call it 4 times 10 to the 5 kilometers. So this is a much simpler method of expressing these distances. And we can see right away from the contrast between these two that the Earth is a much greater distance from the Sun than the Moon is from the Earth. So let's take a look at the next one now. How do we do calculations with these things? Well, let's suppose we want to work out how long it would take us, how much longer it would take to get to the Sun, okay, from the Earth compared to getting to the Moon if we had a constant speed. So in order to do that, we need to divide the distance from the Earth to the Sun by the distance from the Earth to the Moon. So what we're going to do is divide 1.5 times 10 to the 8 by 4 times 10 to the 5 to get the answer using the same units. Important to use the same units, in this case kilometers. Now the answer to that is 0.375 times 10 to the 3 or 3.75 times 10 to the 2 if we want to simplify it. And that's the same thing as 375 times. So it's 375 times further from the Earth to the Sun than it is from the Earth to the Moon. And it would take us 375 times longer if we travelled at a constant speed. So how did we actually do that? How did we actually do the calculation on those numbers? It's important to understand this. You will have learnt this before, but you probably need to be reminded. So now to the next slide, which is slide 12. Well, we basically multiply or divide the first part of an exponential number in the usual way. In the last example, we divided 1.5 by 4 to get 0.375. But then we just subtract the exponents when we divide. 8 minus 5 is 3. If we multiplied the same numbers, what would the answer be? 1.5 times 10 to the 8 multiplied by 4 times 10 to the 5 would be the same thing as 6 times 10 to the 13. Okay? In other words, 1.5 times 4 gives us 6. 8 plus 5 gives us 13. That's the exponent. So doing the mathematics becomes much, much easier when we do things this way. And you'll get the hang of that fairly quickly. But you need to get used to seeing numbers in this form, because sometimes it's the only sensible way to express it. So let's move along now to slide 13. Here's slide 13. We're back to the Andromeda Galaxy again now. Okay? So in exponential notation, the Andromeda Galaxy is 2.4 times 10 to the 22 kilometers away from us. So if we wanted to figure out how much further away that is compared to the Sun, we'll take 2.4 times 10 to the 22 and divide that by 1.5 times 10 to the 8. And we're going to round this off a little bit to make it easier. It's 1.6 times 10 to the 14 times more distant than the Sun, which is an inconceivable number in its own right. So that gives you some idea of the scale between things. When exponents differ by 1, it means they differ by a factor of 10. Okay? If they differ by 14, they're differing by a factor that is well in excess of a trillion, okay, as we would normally do it. So that's a quick illustration of how these things work. So we'll have a look just quickly at some exponential numbers that you should be familiar with in the next slide. So here's some that you should know. I'm not going to tell you what they are right away. What about 6 times 10 to the 23? Anybody think what they know what that is? That one's just a number. It doesn't actually have any units. But it's a very important number in science. Here's another one, 3 times 10 to the 8. Now, clue here, if we were to put a unit on that, it would be a unit of speed. And finally, try this one. What about 3.15 times 10 to the 7? And my clue here is that the units represent time. Now, these are all important things in physical science, and what they are may surprise you to some extent. But you've encountered all these things before, except possibly you might not have encountered the third one. Okay, well, let's just see what they are so we can explain them to the next slide now, which is slide 15. Okay, well, that small glass of water, if it contained 18 grams of water, it would have 6 times 10 to the 23 water molecules in it. Because 6 times 10 to the 23 is Avogadro's number. It's the amount of a substance expressed in grams that represents... It's the number of molecules in the amount of a substance expressed in grams that's equivalent to its molecular or atomic weight. So the molecular weight of water is 18, an oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms. 18 grams of water would contain Avogadro's number of molecules, which is 6 times 10 to the 23. That's a very large number, as you can imagine. Okay. Now, if you were commanding the Enterprise, you've got to travel enormous distances in order to get from star system to star system. Now, the laws of physics tell us that no object can move faster than the speed of light, which is described as c, and that is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. Okay? That's a physical limit. Now, in Star Trek, they get around this by using a warp drive and dilithium crystals, which definitely don't exist, at least not at this point. But that is a physical limit in the universe, and it's the speed of all electromagnetic radiation. Light, X-rays, all of that stuff is traveling at 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. In a vacuum, it will travel a little slower in some other medium. Okay? And what about 3.15 times 10 to the 7? Well, that's the number of seconds in a year. That's about 31 million seconds. So that's how many seconds exist within a year. So these are some familiar quantities that we need, sometimes in calculation, that are expressed as exponential numbers. And you should certainly be familiar with Avogadro's number and with the speed of light. No question about that. So let's go on to the next slide now. Now, this is something that you might want to think about. This is slide 16 in this particular presentation. So the galaxy probably contains about 300 billion stars. Okay, that would be 3 times 10 to the 11 stars. Now, a recent study suggested that there might be as many as 200 trillion galaxies in the entire universe. Now, 200 trillion, expressed as an exponential number, is 2 times 10 to the 14. So the number of stars in the universe is actually less than the number of water molecules in a 2-litre bottle of water that you might buy in Sobeys or Dominion. 2,000 grams of water is more than 100 times 18 grams. And we know that in 18 grams of water, there are 6 times 10 to the 23 water molecules. So that's an interesting conclusion. A bottle of water contains more water molecules than there are stars in the universe, according to this calculation. So that's an interesting thing to think about. Okay, well, that'll do your head in, if nothing else will. Let's just quickly look at a couple of other things about exponential numbers and then move along. So now to the next slide, slide 17. We also use exponential notation for extremely small numbers. If you had a number like 3 times 10 to the minus 4, that means we start with 3 and we move that decimal point 4 places to the left. So that's 0.0003. So the diameter of a hydrogen atom, which is 1 times 10 to the minus 10 meters, okay, is given by that number there. The wavelength of X-rays is 10 to the minus 9 meters. So that's not very much. That's 10 times longer than the diameter of a hydrogen atom. Okay? Calculations for negative exponents follow the same rules as those for positive exponents. You just add or subtract according to whether you're multiplying or dividing. So the same rules apply, and there are times when we need to deal with extremely small numbers. But a lot of time in astronomy and in planetary science, we're dealing with very large numbers. So let's just look at some other units of notation now that are going to be important to us. We'll get away from the exponential stuff for a little while. To the next slide now, which is slide 18, distance and speed. Well, as we've seen, distances are enormous in the universe and the speed of light is immense. And some of the distant galaxies are moving at almost half the speed of light. So what kind of distance measures do we actually use in looking at the universe and looking at the solar system? Obviously, dealing with meters and kilometers is not going to be particularly easy. So we use some other units that are more specific, and you need to be familiar with these. So now to the next slide, which is number 19, astronomical units and light years. So two things that we use the astronomical unit, which is defined as the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Okay? So by definition, we are one astronomical unit away from the Sun. So an astronomical unit is about 150 million kilometers. Okay? 1.496 times 10 to the 8 kilometers to be precise. Okay? So if we were to look at the planet Venus, for example, that's closer to the Sun than we are, that's 0.72 astronomical units from the Sun. And that would be a little over 1 times 10 to the 8 kilometers, 100 million kilometers, basically. So this makes life easy within the solar system. It gives us an easy measure for where things are and how far away they are. So now to the next slide. Light years. Well, light years are a different proposition. Once we get outside the solar system, the distances are so huge that we have to use something different. We use light years. So a light year is the distance that light travels in a year in a vacuum. So as we know, light travels at 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, and there are 3 times 10 to the 7 seconds in a year, roughly. So one light year is about 9 times 10 to the 15 meters, or 9 times 10 to the 12 kilometers, or 6 times 10 to the 4 astronomical units, which is about 60,000 astronomical units. So the nearest stellar neighbour for the solar system is a place called Proxima Centauri, and that's about 4.25 light years away. So that equates to about 250,000 times further away from us than the Sun is. So that's a measure of what a light year is. A light year is a huge chunk of distance compared to our distance to the Sun. Now, you've probably also heard the term parsec. Now, that's used in stellar astronomy. And if you read books and if you read science fiction, you'll often find that it's used interchangeably with light years, which is actually incorrect. A parsec is about 3.26 light years. And it has a rather different origin because it comes from angular measurements and allows calculation from angular observations of the sky. And we'll mention this again a little bit later on. But just remember that it's not quite the same thing. Okay, so let's move along again. That's one of the many pictures of the Starship Enterprise that appear in this particular course. You need to know the difference, okay? Parsec's a contraction of what we call a parallax second. And parallax is a method that we use to estimate the distance of objects that's based on their apparent displacements in the sky. And basically it comes from trigonometry, comes from Pythagoras. So it's an angular measurement. And a second is 1/3600th of a degree. So we're going to talk about parallax a little bit later on. But just remember that a parsec is not the same as a light year. So you can correct people when you read that in the future. So let's go to the next slide now. Take a little break from the math. Proxima Centauri is a very long way away from the Earth. But there is some good news. It has a planet, apparently. This is an exoplanet. It's one of the closest exoplanets that we know of in the galaxy and in the universe. It might be in a habitable zone. Proxima Centauri is a fairly small star, so it wouldn't be that far from the star compared to our distance from the Sun. However, this is a red dwarf that emits quite a lot of X-rays, so it's probably not a very hospitable place. Okay. So the good news is that the closest star to us does apparently have a planet, but the bad news is that it's still a long way away and that planet might not be a particularly useful or particularly desirable place to live. Okay. So let's just move along to another aspect of exponential notation that's quite useful. And that's using exponential notation in graphs and in representing information, which is also very common in science. And there's a very good reason why we do this. So let's take a look at the next slide, which is slide 23. Now, we have to draw graphs and charts often that represent things that happen over enormous timescales or distances or measurements of the amount of something. If we think about the history of the universe, we have to think about time intervals that range from tiny fractions of a second to billions of years. Now, how can you show this on a graph? You cannot show something like this on a linear scale. If you use a linear scale, everything will be condensed in one area. So what we tend to do a lot in science is we use logarithmic graphs. We use exponential graphs. In other words, the axes of the graphs don't move in incremental steps. They move in units of powers of 10. Okay? This allows us to represent quantities and measurements that cover very large ranges. And they're widely used in science. Now, they're widely used because they're convenient. We can represent things in them. But they're also widely used because they often reveal very important relationships. So let's look at the next slide now, which is slide 24. This is a graph that shows the relationship between the orbital periods of the planets in the solar system versus their distance from the Sun. So the period is measured in years and the distance from the Sun is measured in astronomical units. Now you couldn't make a graph like this and if you didn't use a logarithmic scale. You'd have a huge graph and all the inner planets would be on the left-hand corner. But the important thing here is that when we plot this information up on an exponential graph here, we get a straight line. And this is very often the case when we look at relationships between physical quantities, both in planetary science and many other types of science, we find simple relationships when we use exponential methods of representing them. And there's a good reason for that. That's because some of the laws, many of the laws of physics, involve exponential quantities. And in this particular case, there is a clear relationship between the orbital period of planets and their distance from the Sun. And that clear relationship actually relates to Isaac Newton's law of gravitation. Okay? And we'll talk about this later on. But it's just one example of how a linear pattern emerges when we use exponential notation for scales. So let's just look at another example now that involves time. Well, it's not really an example. This is a chart rather than a graph. But this is just an illustration of some of the early events in the history of the universe. Okay? Now, we're not going to talk about this in any detail because this is really outside the scope of this course. What I want you to bear in mind here is that if we look at the notation on the scale, it's in log 10 seconds. So it varies from 10 to the 15, which is well in excess of a million years, okay, to 10 to the minus 15, which is almost no time at all. So this is a way in which we can represent events that take place over very short periods of time and then very long periods of time in a single diagram. Don't worry about the details that are on this chart. It's just another illustration of why exponential notation is useful. And it brings us rather naturally to the next topic, which is a discussion of the units of time that we need in looking at the universe and also at the solar system. So now to the next slide, which is slide 26. Aside from the very early history of the universe, which we don't really talk about much. Most of the time in this course, we're going to be dealing with long, long, long periods of time. And here are some common examples. 1 million years. We know the abbreviate this is 1 MY, and 1 million years ago is 1 MA, which means 1 million years ago. The human species has been around for about 3 or 4 million years in one form or another, if you count some predecessor species to Homo sapiens. Okay, 1 billion years is another measure that's quite common. We'd write that as 1 GY, and if we wanted to say 1 billion years ago, we'd say 1 GA, G standing for giga. It's just like gigabytes. You may encounter BY and BA in some older texts and resources too. How old is the Earth? Well, the Earth formed at a rather convenient number, about 4.567 GA, which is the same thing as 4,567 million years. And that's also roughly the time of formation of the solar system. The human species, of course, is just a tiny fraction of that, as is the presence of complicated life on Earth, too. So there's some examples of the long periods of time that we'll have to deal with in this course. And I usually like to give you an example of this that comes from an old textbook, but I think it's a very good example, in which geological time, or cosmological time in this case, is compressed into the equivalent of a single year. And I'll just put this up now. This is slide 27 coming up now. This says geologic time compressed into a single year. And I won't read this. You can read it yourself. It comes from Don Eicher's book published in 1978. But it's a great illustration of how much time is involved in the history of the Earth. And the Earth itself is only about one third the age of the universe as a whole. Okay, so that's something to think about there. So just read that when you have a chance and think about the length of time that's involved in the Earth's history and in the universe's history. So now to the next slide. This is slide 28. It shows the geological timescale, or at least part of the geological timescale. Some of you will be familiar with this if you've done an Earth Science course. If you've seen Jurassic Park, you know some of this terminology here. The dinosaurs in Jurassic Park were not actually Jurassic. They were actually Cretaceous, but that's beside the point. We also have timescales that we apply to other planetary bodies, such as the Moon and Mars. This basically shows the period of time that we call the Phanerozoic era. Okay, that's the time when we find a lot of fossils in the geological record on Earth. And it's only about 12% of the entire history of the Earth. Most of the history of the Earth is the period that we call the Precambrian. We break it into different chunks. But probably life was around throughout much of that period too. So now to the next slide, which is slide 29. That shows the extent of the full geological timescale. Okay? Life has been around probably since about 3.8 billion years ago, 3.8 GA. The oldest rocks we know of on planet Earth formed at about 4 GA. But we do find some materials, small mineral grains, that are older than this. Now, the solar system has existed for about one third of the time that the universe has existed. The estimate for the age of the universe is a little less certain than the estimate for the age of the Earth, but current estimates are around 13.8 GA. So that, again, is an enormous period of time. So we're living in an extremely old universe, and we're living on an extremely old planet, even though we've only been around for a very, very short period of time by comparison. So let's have a look at the next slide now. We'll kind of switch now from time to temperature. Temperature scales are an important thing to think about too. We have a wide range of temperatures in the solar system. If you go out to Pluto, it's going to be about minus 240 degrees Celsius. If you're on the surface of Venus, it's going to be more than 400 degrees Celsius. If you consider the temperatures inside the Sun, we're getting into millions of degrees Celsius. Now, that's a familiar temperature scale that we all know, but in science we generally use a slightly different temperature scale, which is called the Kelvin scale. Now, the units are the same. 1 degree Kelvin is the same thing as 1 degree Celsius or centigrade, but 0 degree Kelvin is equivalent to minus 273.15 degrees centigrade. And that's the lowest possible temperature when there is no motion of atoms or molecules. That's how it's defined. It's named for Lord Kelvin, who's one of the famous physicists of bygone times and the inventor of thermodynamics. So on the Kelvin scale, the average temperature on planet Earth is about 290 Kelvin, which is about 17 degrees Celsius. So Again, this might seem like a small difference, and a lot of the time it doesn't make much of a difference, especially if you're talking about the temperature inside the sun, but it is important from the perspective of science. Now to the next slide. So why do we use the Kelvin scale? Well, the first reason is it's always positive, okay? And its starting point really is zero. It's the lowest possible temperature that can exist in the universe. Other temperature scales are artificial because they're based around things that are familiar to us, like freezing and boiling points of water, for example. We prefer this because once you get negative numbers in physics equations, it can cause a lot of complications. That's really the essential reason. And it's quite easy to convert between the two. But it's important to remember this difference because very often you will find that temperatures are quoted in degrees Kelvin as opposed to degrees Celsius or degrees centigrade. Celsius and centigrade, of course, are the same thing. They mean the same thing. Okay, so let's have a look at the next slide now. States of matter. Well, this is something you ought to know about. Matter commonly exists in three various forms, which have their own character. So if you take water, for example, it can be a solid, it can be ice, in which case it will hold a shape and will have a fixed volume. It can be a liquid, in which case it will adapt its shape to whatever container you put it in, but it will still have a fixed volume. Or it can be a gas, which will take on the shape of the container and also the volume of the container. So that's the three familiar phases of matter, or states of matter, that we know of. Water is quite remarkable because it can exist in those three states over quite a narrow temperature range, which also happens to be the temperature range on planet Earth as well. But it's important to understand that the phases and states of matter will change according to the physical conditions that apply. What we see for water on the surface of the Earth is not the way water will behave in a vacuum, and it's not the way that water will behave under extreme pressure either. So let's have a look at the next slide now. This is slide 33. The states of matter, or the relationship between states of matter, will change with conditions. Okay? It changes in response to temperature. It'll become a liquid when it's hot, and it'll become a gas when it's really hot. But the state of matter can also relate to pressure. We can keep propane, for example, as a liquid by pressurizing it in a bottle. Okay? We're not changing its temperature, not overtly, we're changing its pressure and it's becoming a liquid. Now, the molecules or the atoms in any item of matter are in motion, and that's what we interpret as heat. So the molecules in a liquid are moving faster than those in a solid, and those in a gas are moving faster than those in a liquid. The other thing to remember is that the physical behavior of a single state of matter will also depend on conditions that apply. And a good example of this is what happens when you try to put butter on your toast when you take it straight from the fridge. It won't work. It's a hard solid. You have to leave it for a while at room temperature, and then it becomes softer and more malleable. It's still a solid. It's not a liquid. But you can spread it, and you can stretch it, and you can move it. You can do things with it. So two things to remember. The phase of matter or the state of matter will change with conditions, and its behavior will also change with conditions. And this can be quite important. Let's have a couple of examples that relate to planetary science where this makes a difference. So let's move on now to the next slide. This is slide 34. So basically, if you think that you have a gas, well, you have atoms and molecules that are moving around. Now, they're all moving around according to their temperature, but some of them are moving faster than others. There's always a range of speeds that they have. So in the atmosphere of a planet, some small gas molecules, some of them may be moving at speeds that are higher than what we call escape velocity, the velocity that's required to escape the gravitational field of the planet. So if you've got one particularly fast molecule out there, it might go fast enough to escape the gravitational pull of a planet and be lost. If the planet is particularly warm, all of those molecules are moving faster, and more of them are moving beyond the escape velocity. So if you have a very warm planet, some molecules are not able to be retained by the gravity of that planet because they're moving too fast and they will be lost. So that's an important consideration when it comes to planetary atmospheres. That's why the outer planets have a lot of light gases, things like hydrogen and helium, with very low atomic numbers in their atmospheres. They're able to retain them. The gravity field of the Earth cannot retain those molecules or those atoms at the temperatures that exist on the Earth. So there's an important illustration. If we go to the next slide now. Well, here's a picture of two planets. Well, one of them's a moon, technically, but it's almost planet size. the Moon and Mercury are both pretty large objects, you know, compared to other moons in the solar system. Anyway, neither of them have any air. They don't have any atmospheres, really. They have transient things called exospheres, which are created by the solar wind interacting with their surface. But they don't retain atmospheres. And that's because the daytime temperatures on the Moon, and certainly the daytime temperatures on Mercury, are far too high for any gas molecule to be retained. Its speed of those molecules would be faster than the escape velocity of the planet, and it would be lost into interplanetary space, hence no atmosphere. So that's an important consequence of the temperature of things and the motion of molecules that represents their temperature. So now to the next slide. This is a diagram, so we'll take a moment to explain this. This is a thing called a phase diagram. It's a phase diagram for H2O, which we know as water or ice or steam. And it shows you under what conditions this will be a solid, will be a liquid, and will be a vapor. So you can see the temperatures expressed in Kelvin on this particular diagram. And you can see that the Earth's atmosphere, if we plot that up there, you can see the pressure in the Earth's atmosphere means that we can have three different phases of H2O. We can have solids, ice, at low temperatures. We can have liquids at intermediate temperatures. And we can have gas at higher temperatures. And the temperature at which something will become a gas changes with the pressure. In other words, at low pressures, such as at the top of a mountain, water will boil more easily than it will boil at sea level. So the behavior of water, the behavior of H2O, varies according to its conditions. On the other hand, if we were to go to Mars, we'd be somewhere in that dark blue box. Okay? So on Mars, it's very hard for liquid water to exist on Mars because the physical conditions generally will not permit it. A solid will not form a liquid when it gets warmer. It will go directly to being a vapor. Now, Mars has lots of evidence suggesting that water did once exist on Mars. So possibly, once it had a thicker atmosphere with a higher pressure, and therefore liquid water was able to exist. But under current conditions, liquid water cannot exist on the planet Mars. So remember that these states of matter change according to condition. So let's have a look at the next slide now. There is, of course, a fourth state of matter that we haven't talked about up till now, and that's actually the most abundant state of matter in the entire universe. And it's not a solid, it's not a liquid, and it's not really a gas, it's plasma. This is electrically conductive material that's made of ionized gas and free electrons moving around in it. We see it on Earth, we see it in lightning, we see it in the flames of a fire. In the universe, it forms stars and many other features that we see. So stars are made of plasma, basically, hot ionized gas. And that's the most abundant state of matter that exists in the universe. So that's worth remembering as well. We will be talking about this. Plasma produces a lot of electromagnetic energy, and that electromagnetic energy is very useful to us in trying to understand the behavior of stars and also to understand the characteristics of objects that reflect that light. So we'll move on from there to another topic that you will have covered in high school and probably didn't remember and hopefully have covered a little more in university. And that, of course, in the next slide, is some aspects of basic chemistry. In particular, we need to talk about atoms, isotopes, ions, and molecules. Okay? Now, nobody likes this stuff. Most people don't remember it with any particular pleasure. But we do need to understand some of it because it's important in planetary science. So this is a very short refresher. And we need to just remember some basic facts and apply them in the remainder of the course. So now to the next slide. Well, first of all, what are elements and atoms? I probably don't need to tell you this, but I'm going to anyway. An element's a basic component of chemistry. It's a substance that you can't break into simpler substances by any chemical means. Chemical elements are organized in a thing called the periodic table of the elements, and you should know what this is. It's an important component of any early science course. So an atom is the basic unit of an element. It's the smallest particle of an element that retains all of the physical and chemical properties of the element. As an example, if I got a piece of copper wire, it's basically made entirely of the element copper. It contains an absolutely enormous amount of individual copper atoms, and each of them is identical to all the others. What do we mean by enormous? What do we mean by huge? Well, in this particular case, if we had 63.5 grams of copper, okay, that's about a bit more than 2 ounces as you'd measure it in imperial measures, that's got 6 times 10 to the 23 atoms of copper in it. And we know that because 6 times 10 to the 23 is Avogadro's number, and 63.5 is the atomic weight of copper. Okay, so we can actually quantify these things. But what are atoms actually made of? Atoms are the smallest units of elements, but they're made of something smaller yet again. So now to the next slide, which is slide 40. Well, every atom, basically, from our perspective, is made up of three kinds of particles, three subatomic particles. We have electrons, which have a negative electrical charge on them and a very small mass. We have protons, which have a positive electrical charge on them and a relatively large mass, although they're still incredibly small. And we have neutrons, which have no electrical charge, and their mass is the same, basically, as a proton and an electron put together. So effectively, they have the same mass as a proton, just a little bit more than that. Protons and neutrons are combined in the central region of an atom we call the nucleus. Electrons sit around the nucleus, and we think of them as being arranged in what we call electron shells. We usually represent these things as a bit like orbits, as if they're moving around the nucleus. That's not strictly what it's like, but it's a very convenient way of looking at it. Electrons that are in close orbits, and some electrons are in more distant orbits too. So they're in a series of positions, if you like, around the nucleus of the atom. And some of them are more easily lost than others. Atoms like to have full electron shells. In other words, they like to have a complete collection of electrons in their electron shells, which means that they're extremely stable. But sometimes they gain electrons or lose electrons. So we'll come to that in a moment now. Let's go to the next slide now. This should look familiar to you. It's the periodic table of the elements. And this is a logical arrangement of chemical elements, which is ordered by their atomic number. And the atomic number is the number of protons in the nucleus of that particular element. And I hope that you'll all remember that columns of elements in the table have similar properties. We can divide it into a variety of columns. We have, for example, the inert gases at the extreme right-hand side, including helium, a very common element in the universe. The far left-hand side, we have the alkali metals, which include sodium and potassium. By and large, at the left-hand side of the table, we have elements that are metals. At the right-hand side of the table, we have elements that are non-metals. Some of them sort of sit in between. Silicon's an important example of this. It's what's called a metalloid. It behaves as a metal in some respects, but can also behave in other respects too. So you should have some knowledge of the periodic table and where elements sit within it and some of the more common elements that you will encounter in planetary science. So let's just look at the next slide now, which explains some of this in a little bit more detail. The number of electrons in an atom determines the nature of ions. If you have a neutral atom, the total number of electrons it contains in all of its electron shells should be the same as the number of protons in the nucleus of that atom. And that way we balance out the electrical charges. A carbon atom, for example, has 6 neutrons and it needs 6 electrons in its outer shell in order to balance that charge out. Now, electrons and protons have equal but opposite electric charges, so that means that atoms are electrically neutral. However, electrically neutral atoms don't do very much. They only do a lot in terms of chemical reactions when they become ions. Ions are charged atoms, and they charge themselves by either losing or gaining an electron. So you can have a positive ion, which is a cation. That means it's got extra electrons, 1 or 2, maybe as many as 5 extra electrons. Sorry. A cation has lost electrons, I had that wrong, so therefore it's got a positive charge. An anion has gained electrons and has a negative charge. So that's how atoms become ions. So now to the next slide. Are all atoms of an element the same? Well, no, not really. All atoms of a given element have the same number of protons in their nucleus, and that determines how they behave. Okay? So, carbon always has 6 protons in its nucleus. However, atoms also have neutrons in their nucleus as well. And that can vary, and it doesn't affect the chemical properties of the element. So, most chemical elements in the periodic table have more than one isotope. An isotope of an element has the same number of protons, always, but a different number of neutrons. And isotopes are extremely important in all aspects of science, and especially in planetary science. One important reason is that some isotopes are unstable. Over time, they will gradually change into another isotope of another element, and the rate at which they change can be measured. And that gives us natural clocks. It gives us a method of dating, in this case minerals and rocks. It gives us a method of finding out when something formed, because we can measure how much of a radioactive isotope has decayed, and from that we can figure out how long that particular substance has been around. A second reason they're important is that stable isotopes of light elements, if you talk about things like oxygen, sulfur, or also hydrogen, the difference in the relative mass of an atom by having an extra neutron or two is quite significant for a light element. And that means that their reaction rates in different processes will be different. Chemical reaction processes may favor one isotope over another isotope for light elements, and that gives us a sort of a fingerprint. It's a fingerprint, for example, of different sources for particular elements and things of that nature. It can also tell us when something has had an organic influence in creating it. Quite a powerful technique, what we call stable isotopes at one end of the spectrum, which are usually light elements, and radioactive isotopes, which are usually heavier elements that decay into other isotopes. So basically, isotopes are made by the presence of extra neutrons. So let's look at a couple of examples here. In the next slide now, which is 44, all atoms of carbon have an atomic number of 6. They've all got 6 protons. Some carbon atoms have 6 neutrons, some of them have 7 neutrons, and some of them have 8 neutrons. And that means that there are 3 isotopes of carbon that we have. And they have mass numbers, in other words, atomic weights, of 12, 13, and 14. So we write those 3 as 12C, 13C, and 14C. Hydrogen, for example, has 3 isotopes. It has regular hydrogen, and it has one called deuterium, which has 1 extra neutron, and it has one called tritium, which has 2 extra neutrons. Heavy water that's used in atomic power plants is basically water that's made with deuterium. Oxygen's got 2 common isotopes with atomic weights of 16 and 18. If you go to the other end of the scale, uranium has lots and lots of isotopes, and many of them are radioactive. 2 important ones are 235 uranium and 238 uranium. So isotopes are very valuable things to planetary scientists. They give us geological clocks that we can use to date events, and they give us a way of tracing processes or giving fingerprints for the sources of particular chemical elements. So we'll look at a couple of examples that illustrate these uses. First of all, how old is the Earth and the solar system? Well, we figure this out by dating meteorites, by looking at the decay of 2 uranium isotopes that we just mentioned to 2 different isotopes of lead. We can calculate the ages of meteorites, and they're all older, almost all older than 4.5 billion years. Meteorites are the building blocks of the terrestrial planets, we're fairly sure of this. So when we get an age for meteorites, then we have an age for the terrestrial planets themselves. So that's how old the Earth and the solar system are, and that's how we know, basically. Second question is the one of where did the water in our oceans come from? Well, for a long time, there was an idea that the water in Earth's oceans came from comets, which are mostly made of ice and other volatile elements or molecules. However, we now have some measurements of the ratios of hydrogen isotopes in comets, and that suggests that they're very different to those that we see in Earth's oceans. So that looks as if that idea is not correct. It doesn't look as if the water in Earth's oceans came from comets that collided with the Earth. It must come from some other source, likely inside the Earth. So those are 2 examples of the use of isotopes to answer some fundamental questions about the solar system. Now to the next slide. This is slide 46. This just shows you the concept of radioactive decay and another important concept called half-life. So in other words, if you have a radioactive parent isotope and a stable daughter isotope, the radioactive parent will gradually decay over time, and the stable daughter isotope will gradually increase over time. And we can measure that rate of decay. Surprisingly, not surprisingly really, it's an exponential function that governs this. Okay? And that gives us a thing called the half-life. The half-life is a pretty important concept. So the half-life is the period of time needed for half of the atoms of a radioactive isotope to decay to a daughter isotope. And we can measure it in the lab. If we can measure it in the lab, we have a way of understanding the speed of the clock. If we know the speed of the clock, then we can figure out when it started. Okay? So after a larger number of half-lives, if you go to about 5 half-lives, for example, the radioactive isotope, the parent isotope, has essentially disappeared. It's become extinct. and all we have left is the stable daughter isotope. So the isotopes that we use in planetary science have a range of half-lives, and we'll talk about this later on, and we use them for different purposes, but they give us powerful ways of measuring time for different events within the solar system and on individual planets. And I'll just mention that quickly in the next slide a little bit more. This is slide 47, talks about extinct isotopes. If we look at natural radioactive isotopes that occur today, they all have very long half-lives. They all have half-lives that are greater than 700 million years, which is a long time. So all natural primary radioactive isotopes, meaning that they're at the start of a decay chain, we'll talk about that a little bit later, are very long-lived. But they're the only ones that are left around, because there are extinct radioactive isotopes too. What about the past? In the early days of the solar system, if we go back 4.5 billion years, there were a whole load of radioactive isotopes that existed following the formation of the sun that are now extinct. They don't exist anymore because they've run down. But they were very important sources of energy in the early solar system. And their daughter isotopes are still around. The ones that they created still exist. So we can actually use these extinct isotopes to understand early events in the history of the solar system. Even though the isotopes are long gone, we can still use their former presence to understand some of these events. This is a little bit of a difficult concept, and we'll talk about it a little bit more later on, but it is quite amazing when you think about it. Okay, now to the next slide. Well, we're almost at the end now. You'll be happy to know that. I'm happy to know that. I don't really like going through all these basic science things, but we have to do it. We need to talk just briefly about computer models, or what I call the two-edged sword of computer models. And you might have heard an expression called garbage in, garbage out, and that applies regardless of what kind of computer you have. If you put nonsense into it, you'll get nonsense out of it, even if it's a supercomputer. Now, as you will discover in the next few weeks, 21st century planetary science really depends a lot on computer models. And they're done with supercomputers like this thing. And they're specially designed to solve hugely complex problems. And examples might be the motions of all the planets in the solar system and how they interact with one another, or the fusion reactions that take place inside the sun. So computer models are extremely valuable, but they do have some limits, and there's a few things that you need to bear in mind whenever we talk about computer models suggest this or computer models demonstrate this, because they're not always cut and dried. So let's just have a look at this slide, which is the last slide in the presentation. It's slide 49. And these are my rules of computer model theory. Now, they're not published, and they'll probably never be published, but they're things to bear in mind. The first one is that every computer model, doesn't matter how good it is or how complex it is, it depends on assumptions and inputs. If you put in the wrong figures, the results you get out at the other end are probably going to be invalid. If, for example, you calculate your earnings and you put in the wrong salary, then obviously you'll get the wrong answer at the end of it. The second thing to remember is that some computer models are more reliable than others, and the most reliable ones are those that use a method called ensemble prediction. And that means that they do multiple runs that change inputs and assumptions as they go through. And that's how weather forecasts are done. This was really developed for weather forecasting, which is actually a huge computer prediction problem. Okay? If you can do this, if the results converge when you vary inputs and assumptions, then that probably is a measure that the model is quite reliable, because it's quite robust. It will withstand changes in input parameters. The third thing is that if a computer model says that something is impossible or highly unlikely, that's more likely to be a correct answer than the conclusion that something might be possible. Okay? Models can often rule things out on the basis of probability. Okay? They can set such a low probability for such an event that you'll say, well, that's not likely to happen. And the last, and certainly the most important one from my perspective, you should always remember that because a computer model concludes that something is possible, it does not prove that it actually happened that way. These are models, and there may be other mechanisms to produce those results. So we're going to run into these quite a bit in the next few weeks, and some of them are quite interesting. They're all interesting, really. But bear these things in mind, because very often the results of computer models have been shown to be incorrect or at least ill-advised. So that's all we have to say in the basic science module of this course. We're going to come back for our next broadcast in a little while to talk about some basic principles of geological science, which are very important too, especially with respect to the terrestrial planets. I haven't included a list of summary slides in this presentation because it really is background material. But you can think about what we talked about. Hopefully much of this was familiar. If not, hopefully much of it makes sense. And we'll talk to you again soon when Radio Solar System comes back on the air with a review of basic geological concepts. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.